welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, January 2nd, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. We'll start with a brief look at the weather. Today, Sunday and Monday are all going to be mostly cloudy. Today we'll have a high of 24, lows in the low to mid-teens. Pretty much the same for tomorrow. On Monday, a little bit warmer with a high of 32, but still lows in the mid-teens. For those keeping track, the record low, you may recall, back in 2018, it was minus 23 degrees. The lead story on the Gazette's front page is by Gage Miskimen of the Gazette, titled Uptown Marion Project on Verge of Starting. Dateline, Marion. The city's long-anticipated Uptown Transforming Streetscape project is gearing up to begin construction this spring. The project, estimated to cost $6.5 million, has been in the making for a decade. Other large building projects in the area have begun or are about to, making for a series of changes expected to transform Uptown. Marion Community Development Director Tom Treharn said work is planned to begin in late April. He said, "We've always said we can't do it until 6th Avenue is done, but that was not completed in 2020. It should be paved in the spring." 6th Avenue currently stops at 22nd Street, with a chunk left to be paved to connect it to a roundabout where 7th Avenue connects near 26th Street. A new Marion Public Library has broken ground and is underway across the street from the existing library. Next to City Square Park, the Marion Square Plaza is set to be redeveloped into a new mixed-use facility, with two large buildings for commercial and residential spaces called Broad and Main. The first of the two buildings is set to be completed in 2022. Treharn said the Strip's malls redevelopment is pushing the streetscape project to move along and said, "We have the huge redevelopment on the mall site, so the critical thing now with that investment is there will be that streetscape that needs to be done in front of that building. It's pushed us along." The streetscape project begins at the 7th Avenue and 7th Street roundabout and extends eastward all the way to 12th Street on 7th Avenue. The project also will include work on 10th Street between 6th and 8th Avenues, which currently has brick road. Treharn said, "At this point, I don't foresee there being brick streets developed." The highest degree of change will happen on 7th Avenue between 10th and 12th Streets. This area of the street sits between a row of historic uptown buildings and City Square Park and the current Marion Square Plaza. Treharn said that area of road is proposed to become a, quote, festival street, which means there will be no curbs and it can be shut down for events and be more walkable. Some early renderings show the road with no curb, new spaces for parking along the street, and new lighting, potentially including decorative features that look like leaves. Treharn said, "The leaves have been a point of conversation from the get-go, but they are not 100% at this point. The idea was drawing off the amphitheater at Lowe Park that has a giant oak leaf that overlooks it." Treharn said there has been, quote, questionable support for the leaf designs, but nothing is final. There's also a strong desire to work with local artists to create these features, he said. He also said as of mid-December, the city had about 70% of the engineering plans and wants to get the plans finalized this month. Quote, "Our next step is to get this out in front of the public for conversation." End quote. Treharn added that the idea is to have most of the project completed by the end of summer 2022, but phasing throughout the project will be important so as to not close down the entirety of Uptown and disrupt businesses for multiple construction seasons. He said, "We may start on the 12th Street side and then move into the core area. There's also a roundabout proposed at Central and 10th Street, so we have to make sure we can't shut down everything at the same time." He noted there also is stormwater and utility work needed to be verified before final decisions on phasing can be made, but he said the idea is to keep the impact to businesses as low as possible. The other large portion of Uptown Marion's transformation is the Uptown redevelopment that would transform City Square Park completely while still leaving its historic train depot, which was damaged during the August derecho. The depot, however, is a separate project at this point, Treharne said. Quote, we did a preliminary design and cost for the park part of the Central Plaza design. We took that to concept, and we're going to keep it here for now because we have to get detailed design work underway for the rest of it, end quote. The park's redesign includes a ring area of the plaza that can be transformed into an ice skating rink during the winter, planters that double as fire pits, water features for splashing around in the summer, and an artistic playground feature. The cost of the park's upgrades is estimated to be about $5.3 million, but the project won't happen until the streetscape itself is complete. Treharne said most of the streetscape and plaza dollars will come through bonding. He said the Central Plaza piece of the project could see fundraising and grants to assist with the cost. Quote, this will likely be a phased project, where we do a portion of it and come back in 2023 with the plaza. Once streetscape is underway, we will most likely do a final design of the plaza area and take a stronger look at the depot, end quote. Treharne said for now, the city is looking to clean up the depot and make modifications to keep it intact. And the article concludes by saying the city will host a January 14th, quote, online public engagement, end quote, session about the project. Details about the session are available on the city's website at cityofmarion.org. The other local article on the front page of the Gazette is titled Hawkeye Family, Comforts in Time of Angst. This is from Vanessa Miller, Dateline, Iowa City. New college graduates always face uncertainty. Will they get a job? Where will they live? What will become of their career ambitions and dreams? And, practically speaking, how will they cover the bills after, in many cases, having relied on parents? In 2020, COVID-19 confounded these concerns, leaving college graduates not only uncertain or uncomfortable, but unnerved and afraid. Jia Ern Ong, age 22, was one such University of Iowa alumna. After graduating in May with a neuroscience degree, she faced the daunting task of launching into a shifting and, in some fields, desolate workforce. Ong said, toward the end of the semester, it was kind of hitting crunch time because you look at the news and each and every single day, unemployment here, unemployment there. It wasn't like I had many options available for me, end quote. She applied for jobs near her hometown in Wisconsin, but came up empty. After refocusing her search to Iowa City, Ong, in July, landed a UI Hospital and Clinics internship. She said, I was very lucky to get that position. So many of my other classmates were looking for opportunities and they just fell through. They had them all lined up and all of a sudden, I'm sorry, but we're furloughing the employees we already have and so we can't afford to take somebody new on. It was just such a time of uncertainty, end quote. Amid the unknowns, Ong reached out to a favorite professor, a mentor she calls a true treasure, seeking inspiration, comfort, and guidance as the pandemic raged. Ong connected with David Gould, a visiting associate professor in the UI Public Policy Center. Ong said, there is great power and a bright light in a teacher that truly cares and invests their time in their students. I am incredibly blessed to have someone like him to walk beside and guide me in times of anguish and glory. And Ong wasn't alone. Gould told the Gazette, I always get nice little updates, the holiday notes and things like that, but these were different. My students were writing me in different degrees of fear. I don't want to overplay it, but some were really in a panic situation where I've lost my job and I don't know what to do. Others were just feeling for the first time the floor was shaking, end quote. Those reaching out were new grads to alumni in the 25 to 35 or even 40-year-old age range. And they were contacting Gould via text, email, and social media. He said, I stopped counting, but it was upward of 150 or 160 when I stopped counting. He noted the connection shared a theme, They were looking at their options. They were looking at people that could help them brainstorm what they could do. That forced Gould to ask, similarly, what he could do. "I certainly can't fix the economy," he said. "I can't manufacture hundreds and thousands of jobs," but there was a real thinking of, "I may have to rewrite my story at this point. The novel of my life is taking a detour here, and I may need to figure out a different way to thrive," end quote. He collaborated with leaders and colleagues in the Public Policy Center about something to offer at the institutional level and took a cue from the Hawkeye family notion. He asked, "What do families do when the times get tough?" Working with the UI Center for Advancement and the Tippie College of Business, Gould dreamed up a version of the UI Life Design course he created a decade ago to help students discover what they are innately drawn to do. The course guides students, often in their early 20s, toward answers to questions such as, "Who am I? What do I want to do? What do I care about?" Gould said, "The 20s are a disruptive time when those are all coming to the surface and those are all magnified. And so, acknowledging real tragedy and turmoil this year, he asked whether 2020, in a broader sense, has served as a reminder that disruption never ends. He said, "As you go through life, the landscape continually changes. Even if things feel pretty good, you're just constantly checking your compass." Perhaps these times serve as a wonderful opportunity for individuals, regardless of age, to really think about the life that we want to live. Gould said, "We got a little bit of a pause here. Everything got quieter, and everything got more restricted. So, what really matters?" End quote. In his first ever free and public life design course, offering weekly virtual experiences last month, he has compiled a group of speakers to help friends and family answer that question. Speakers include legendary Hawkeye wrestling coach Dan Gable, recent recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, as well as Kathy Eldon, author, filmmaker, and co-founder of the Creative Visions Foundation. Andy Stoll, UI graduate and senior program officer of entrepreneurship at the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation, and Dan Lerner, a New York University psychology professor and happiness guru. The 4:30 to 6 p.m. Wednesday installments, starting next week with Stoll, will feature presentations from the highlighted speakers, an opportunity for small group discussion, and what Gould calls some little magic wrinkles. He means music, performances, storytelling, and guest appearances. He said, "These little surprises that would be peppered in with the featured guests, and I'm actually going to have office hours." The quote class involves a syllabus, website, assignments for those who want them, and even academic advisors for any participants wanting to go deeper. The course has no weekly participation cap, and attendees can participate in 1, 2, 3, or all 4. Although Gould has become known for his communal and innovative higher education instruction, launching a tight-knit green room course in 2016 and inviting the community to participate in a public version the following year, this pandemic-propelled project will be entirely online for the same existential reason. He said, "There are pros and cons to everything. The con of being on Zoom is we're not going to be together, but the good news is that you can be anywhere in the world." Gould has participants signed up in India. Stoll told the Gazette he never says no to a Gould invitation and grasps the immense need for such a collaborative initiative now. With his extensive entrepreneurship experience, Stoll said he plans during his presentation next week to share insights from his world travels and views about how and why entrepreneurs thrive in 2020-type conditions. Stoll said, "I spent most of my professional career working to help people who think of themselves as entrepreneurs and creatives, and a lot of that work is dealing with uncertainty and risk and trying to find your path." Noting a massive uptick in entrepreneurship last year, Stoll said individuals carving out a new and personalized career path have ideas and they want to turn them into something. He said, "I think 2020, if it's had any silver linings, has given many of us the chance to pause a little bit and think about where our lives are and what's important and what we want to do with them. If you know someone who's interested or you're interested yourself, advance registration for the course is required. For details, you can go to facebook.com and then UI Advancement, and you click on Events. Let's move to the Iowa Today section. There are two public safety articles to start with, one from Aaron Jordan of the Gazette under the title Shooting and Stabbing Under Investigation. Dateline Cedar Rapids. Police are investigating shots fired and a related stabbing that happened early Friday. Officers were dispatched to the 600 block of Center Point Road Northeast just before 2 a.m. for a report of a stabbing, according to a Cedar Rapids police news release. Additional calls said there had been shots fired in the same area. When police arrived, they found shell casings in a parking lot. A person with a stab wound later showed up at a hospital, police reported. The injury was not life-threatening. Police interviewed the witnesses and persons stabbed and collected evidence at the scene. No one has been charged and the investigation is ongoing. The second article, also from Aaron Jordan, is I See Man Charged with Sex Abuse and Burglary, Dateline Iowa City. An Iowa City man faces sex abuse and burglary charges after an incident Wednesday night. Jonathan K. Mimpiana, age 22, was arrested and charged with third-degree sex abuse and first-degree burglary. A woman reported she had picked up a food delivery outside her apartment in the 1900 block of Broadway Street around 7:15 p.m. Wednesday, when Mimpiana started talking with her and pushed his way inside her apartment. Mimpiana checked every room in the apartment, including the room where the woman's four-year-old daughter was sleeping, while the woman told him repeatedly to leave, police reported. She managed to get Mimpiana to her front door, where he told her he wanted to party and tried kissing her several times before putting his hands down her pants and touching her, police said. The victim was eventually able to get the defendant out of her apartment before calling the police, the criminal complaint states. The victim stated she was scared and felt unsafe at her apartment. Mimpiana later denied the incident to police but said he did have some interaction with the woman. First-degree burglary is a Class B felony, punishable by up to 25 years in prison, and third-degree sex abuse is a Class C felony, which carries up to 10 years in prison. On a more pleasant note is an article titled Eastern Iowans Greet New Year Outdoors. It's also from Aaron Jordan. Dateline Coralville. Jurg Sheeran rode nearly 6,500 miles on his bicycle in 2020, according to his Strava app, but he was back on his fat tire bike for a ride through the snow New Year's Day. Sheeran, age 51, who's of Iowa City, said it's beautiful out here about the Woodpecker Trail single-track bicycle course in Coralville, especially when it's snowing. While New Year's Day brings many indoor pleasures, such as watching football and eating holiday leftovers, some Eastern Iowans sought the outdoors to jumpstart 2020 with nature and exercise. Sheeran joined David Heitbrink, age 42, and Adam Harding, age 40, both of Coralville, for a ride along the 3.4-mile east loop of the trail that dips and loops through the woods by Clear Creek. Fluffy, wet flakes of rapidly falling snow added to the 9 inches that fell earlier in the week. The Iowa Coalition of Off-Road Riders grooms the trails, which are meant for fat tire bikes in winter. Fat tires, which are 3.8 inches or wider, float over debris and don't cause ruts on the trails, Heitbrink said. He also said it's nice to get out. The treadmill is boring as you know what. Cross-county skiers and snowshoers also were enjoying the snow this week. The Iowa City Nordic Club on Wednesday groomed trails at Kent Park near Tiffin and also prepped a cross-country skiing trail along the University of Iowa's Ashton cross-country course, according to the group's Facebook page. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources usually does guided hikes on New Year's Day, but because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the agency instead challenged Iowans to check in with the state park passport at one of 50 state parks through Sunday. Every check-in counts as an entry into a prize drawing for a free two-night stay in a two-bedroom cabin at Lake Darling State Park. Jenny Morton, age 36, of Cedar Rapids, planned to go hiking with a couple of friends at Lake McBride State Park on Friday afternoon. She said, "I like the idea of starting the first day of the year in nature. It feels symbolic. Plus, it's a healthy note that sets the right tone." Morton said she and her spouse have always been brown sign enthusiasts who stop to explore nature areas. She said, "But this year, it's also been one of the few ways we've been able to safely be around friends. To laugh and hold conversation while in the fresh air has taken on a new importance." And as you might imagine, there are some lovely winter pictures of folks with their fat tire bikes riding through those various locations mentioned in the story. Also included in the Iowa Today section is a report about the status of COVID in Iowa, titled "Hospitalizations for COVID Down Over the Past Month," written by Aaron Jordan. Hospitalizations from COVID-19 in Iowa are down by half from what they were a month ago. Iowa reported 575 hospitalizations New Year's Day, compared to 1,172 COVID-19 patients hospitalized December 1st. And it's more than a blip, with four of the last 7 days having fewer than 600 hospitalizations. Of people hospitalized Friday, 117 were in intensive care and 63 were on ventilators. Both numbers were down from the previous day. Iowa reported 2,133 new cases of COVID-19 Friday, for a total of 282,439. There were 7 new confirmed deaths, for a total of 3,898 overall in the state. Of the people who died from the virus, 4 were older than 80, and 3 were ages 61 to 80, the state reported. There were 4,627 test results reported Friday, including 2,133 positives. 39 of Iowa's 99 counties have a 14-day positivity rate over 15%. Linn County's rate was 9.1%. Johnson County's was 9.7%. Johnson County added 77 cases as of Friday's report, ticking up from what had been a steady decline for most of December. Iowa has 109 outbreaks at long-term care facilities, down 2 from Thursday, and 4,558 people in these facilities have tested positive. There were 1,139 reported deaths. One of the long-term care centers removed from the outbreak list was Monticello Nursing and Rehab Center, which was added to the list November 10th and had 72 cases at its peak. The top 10 counties in total COVID-19 cases are first Polk, then Linn, Scott, Blackhawk, Woodbury, Johnson, Dubuque, Pottawatomie, Story, and at number 10 is Dallas. Before we move to the editorial and community letters, we will read this brief article. Pharmacist accused of destroying vaccine identified by jail records. A former pharmacist from Milwaukee, who's been jailed for destroying more than 500 doses of the Moderna vaccine for COVID-19, has been identified by jail records, according to reports. The suspect, who has since been fired from his job at the Aurora Medical Center in Grafton, Wisconsin, is accused of pulling 57 vials of the coronavirus treatment from the refrigerator and leaving them out overnight. He knew it would render the vaccines useless and lead people to believe they'd been vaccinated properly, police said. While authorities have not yet officially released the suspect's identity, Stephen Brandenburg, age 47, a licensed pharmacist, was booked Thursday at the Ozaukee County, Wisconsin jail on counts of criminal damage to property and second-degree recklessly endangering safety, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He remained behind bars Friday but has not been formally charged. Jeff Baer, president of Aurora Healthcare Medical Group, called the suspect a bad actor during a virtual news conference Thursday afternoon. He did not provide a motive. The Aurora Medical Center said in a statement that the pharmacist admitted to intentionally removing the vaccine, knowing that if not properly stored, the vaccine would be ineffective. And now moving to the inside page of the Gazette, the Gazette's editorial today is titled Help for the Most Vulnerable. With the new year comes the expected arrival of two long-awaited projects meant to serve some of Iowa's most difficult-to-serve populations. Both Linn and Johnson counties expect to open new mental health access centers in the early months of 2021. They will offer a range of services to people experiencing mental health or substance abuse crises, which organizers hope will be a better use of law enforcement and health care resources. The GuideLink Center in Johnson County is a newly constructed building on Southgate Avenue in Iowa City. The Linn County Mental Health Access Center will be housed in an existing county building on 13th Street Northwest in Cedar Rapids. Each will be collaboratively operated by local government and area nonprofits. The new facilities address two of the issues this editorial board has focused on in recent years: law enforcement and mental health care. Too often, police in Iowa are tasked with handling mental health crises when Iowans are poorly served by other resources. Officers in both counties participate in crisis intervention training, which is important, but does not solve the underlying problems. Without another option, mentally ill people sometimes are taken to jails or emergency rooms, which are expensive solutions with poor outcomes. The forthcoming centers in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City provide a much-needed third option, a safe place to take people instead of a jail cell or a hospital room. Ultimately, it could save taxpayers money while also offering better care to the people who need it most. The projects were delayed by the pandemic and the derecho, but there also have been political disagreements about funding and oversight. During the development, we voiced our concern that the counties seem to be operating in silos without adequate regional or statewide coordination. That concern lingers, but we are optimistic for the future. The coronavirus pandemic and the public's demand for law enforcement reform, we hope, have given local leaders a clearer view of their priorities. And the editorial concludes, after what was a terrible year in many ways, Eastern Iowa stands to start 2021 on a positive note. And the Gazette also has included one community letter. This one is titled Linn County Going Backward on Marijuana Enforcement. It is submitted by Josh Montgomery of Ames. Linn County recently announced a diversion program for first-time marijuana offenders, detailed in a December 29th Gazette article. Unfortunately, the program is not just ineffective at rectifying Iowa's indefensible marijuana stance, it creates additional precedent that embarrasses Iowa on a national stage regarding sensible cannabis policy. The new program traps first-time defendants into, quote, voluntarily entering a deal to have their charge dropped that requires completion of many unnecessary, inefficient actions, a devil's bargain. The most disturbing action labels program entrants as, quote, substance abusers. This represents a fundamental misunderstanding of the national reckoning on the necessity to legalize and educate. The Linn County attorney has claimed this program addresses racial disparities in arrests where Iowa has horrifically led the nation in the past. Iowa denizens, do not be distracted by this hollow juke move. Through its disturbingly on-brand legislative inaction on cannabis reform, Iowa continues to serve as contrarian to sensible drug policy and racially sensitive lawmaking. Weed should be legal everywhere for adults. We must legalize and educate for safe access. Linn County is doing the opposite by requiring stigmatized classes for simple adult use, despite the fact that marijuana is medically or recreationally legal in a majority of states. Iowa's neighbors have robust medical or recreational programs. We are in last place. And Josh Montgomery concludes by saying, Linn County residents and all Iowans must question why the Linn County attorney wants to, quote, divert Iowans into a program that labels them substance abusers when they would not be if a mere 90 miles east. Right above that community letter is a cartoon that has been submitted by Clay Bennett. It was posted in the Chattanooga paper. It is a writing pen, and it's just sitting there as a writing pen, and above it, it says 2021 New Year's Resolution in handwriting line underneath it, and then it just says return to normal. Maybe that's something you can relate to. Just a reminder, you are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, January 2nd, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. We'll start with the brief notices from Belle Plain Hawanda W. Perk, also known as Dolly, age 97, died Thursday, New Year's Eve. Rayback Niehaus Funeral Home in Belle Plain is assisting the family. In Marengo, Sheila J. Hudepohl, H-U-E-D-E-P-O-H-L, age 68, also died on New Year's Eve. Closter Funeral Home in Marengo is assisting the family. In Stanley, Brenda M. Irvine, age 66, died on New Year's Eve. Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home in Olwine is in charge of those arrangements. From Vinton, Michael C. Davis, age 58, died Monday, December 28th. Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton is providing those services. In West Branch, Helen Erickson Peterson, age 90, died Wednesday, December 30th. The family is being assisted by Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Branch. And in West Liberty, M. Peg Anderson, age 88, died on New Year's Eve. Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Branch is in charge of those arrangements. Moving to the longer notices, Roger Henry Hermsen, H-E-R-M-S-E-N, age 85, of Manchester and formerly of Earlville, passed away New Year's Eve at the Edgewood Convalescent Home in Edgewood. The family wants to thank the Edgewood Convalescent Home for all the great care. There will be a massive Christian burial at 11 a.m. Tuesday, January 5th at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester. Visitation will be on that same day from 9 to 10:30 a.m. at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Interment will be at St. Mary Catholic Cemetery in Manchester. There is a reminder that because of COVID-19, masks are required at the funeral home and at the church. John J. Nolan, age 73, of Wellman, died Sunday, December 27th at UI Hospitals and Clinics following a stroke. It says that no public services are being planned at this time, but memorial donations can be made in his memory to the Iowa City Bike Library, Wellman Senior Dining, or the UI Children's Hospital. They also invite others to share a thought, memory, or condolence through the funeral home website, which is gayandchia.com. The obituary is quite long, but one point I'll just mention is that it says one particular contract, he apparently had worked for Xerox, and it said he had a 30-plus year relationship with the Sports Information Department of University of Iowa men's basketball and football teams. Iona G. Madden, age 89, of rural Oxford, died at her former home on Monday, December 28th of 2020. And they say, again, this is a Gay and Shia funeral notice, and it says no public services are being planned at this time. Details will be announced at a later date, but again, you're off, invited to share a thought, memory, or condolence with her family through the funeral home's website at gayandchia.com. William Andrew, known as Andy, Roberge, R-O-B-E-R-G-E, age 40, formerly of Iowa City, died Wednesday, December 30th from an accident in his home in Ankeny. Private family services are planned. A celebration of life will be planned later this year. They do mention that in lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to an educational fund for Andy's children. The final local obituary is for Beverly Joy Brecht, age 89, of Central City, who passed away on Wednesday, December 30th, at The Views in Marion. A parish vigil service will be held at 4 p.m. this Monday at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. The family will greet friends following the vigil service until 7 p.m. at the funeral home. And then a funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday, January 5th, at St. Stephen's Catholic Church in Central City. Burial will be at Mount Clark Cemetery in Central City. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a face mask and practice social distancing. Those who are interested in memorials are asked to direct those to the St. Stephen Parish Ladies Guild. In the obituaries is also a celebrity obituary that I'll take a moment to read. Phyllis McGuire, the last of the Singing Sisters, has died at age 89. The lead singer and younger sister of Dorothy and Christine McGuire, the McGuire sisters, died on Tuesday in Las Vegas. The Palm Eastern Mortuary and Cemetery confirmed on Thursday a cause of death was not provided. Known for their sweet harmonies and identical outfits and hairdos, the McGuire sisters earned 6 gold records for hits, including 1954's Sincerely and 1957's Sugar Time. The group performed for 5 presidents and Queen Elizabeth II of Great Britain. They were inducted into the National Broadcasting Hall of Fame in 1994 and the Vocal Group Hall of Fame in 2001. The Las Vegas Sun reported Phyllis McGuire died at her mansion she called the Beverly Hills of Las Vegas in the Rancho Circle Estates near downtown Las Vegas. The 26,000 square foot home includes a 45 foot version of the Eiffel Tower. The McGuire sisters began singing together as children at their mother's Ohio church and then performed at weddings and church revivals. They rose to popularity during World War II and got their show business break in 1952 with an appearance on The Kate Smith Show. They quit performing as a trio at the height of their popularity in 1968, but returned to the stage as a threesome in 1985. The three last performed together in the mid-2000s. The Gazette has 2 basketball articles, one for girls and one for boys, and we'll start out with the girls. High school basketball reset. This is from Jeff Linder, and it says girls 1-2 face-off kicks off 2021 reboot. Mr. Linder says it wasn't the weather that wreaked havoc on the pre-holiday portion of the girls' basketball season. It was the virus. Dozens of area games were postponed or canceled through December, whether it was from COVID-19 outbreaks or online learning. The season resumes precariously today, and the slate includes a biggie at Delhi, where Class 2A top-ranked Maquoketa Valley welcomes number 2 North Lynn in a Tri-Rivers Conference West Division showdown. Tip-off is at 12:30 p.m. North Lynn, at 6-0 overall, 1-0 in division play, is the defending 2A state champion and is riding a 12-game win streak. The Lynx have beaten their first 6 foes by 40 points a game, and their top scorers, Cameron Kurt and Macy Boge, are freshmen. Maquoketa Valley, at 7-0, 3-0 in conference play, counters with a veteran lineup led by the senior trio of Taya Tucker, 16 points a game, Ella Immler at 13, and Emerson Wittenbaugh also at 13. The Wildcats' 26.0 point defensive average is second best in the 2A. Here's a glimpse into some area races as the season resumes. In the MVC Mississippi division, an overview states Cedar Rapids, Washington, at 5-0, has assembled the most impressive resume thus far based on its overtime win over Class 5A preseason number 1 Waterloo West. The Warriors have been bolstered by the return of Sydney Midfalski, who missed a big chunk of her junior year due to injury. The MVC overall figured to have 4 heavyweights, and the emergence of the Warriors makes it 5. The MVC Valley Division overview says, which West will it be? Waterloo West at 4-1 was a state semifinalist last year and carried the tag of preseason 5A favorite this season. The Wahawks haven't always dominated, though. In addition to their loss to Washington, they trailed Dubuque Wallard after three quarters before rallying and squandered most of a 22-point lead against Western Dubuque before escaping 62-60 in their last game before the break. Iowa City West at 2-0, meanwhile, has taken advantage of its limited opportunities, opening with double-digit wins over Iowa City High and Linmar. The Trojans head to Waterloo for their pivotal meeting January 8th. In the Wamak East Division, a five-year run of Wamak Divisional Championships has reached a crossroads for Marion at 3-4. Graduation has gradually chipped away at the Indians' power, and the injury to Riley Wright has brought them back to the pack. Solon at 6-2 has pounced on the opportunity. The Spartans have stacked five straight wins together, including a pivotal 55-43 victory over the Indians on December 15th. The rematch is January 19th at Marion. The overview for the Wamak West Division says, definitely the deeper of the two Wamak divisions, the West houses five quality teams. For now, Clear Creek Amana at 6-1 can claim itself as the best team in the entire conference. With 3 6-footers in their lineup, the Clippers already have wins over Centerpoint Urbana, who's 7-2, and Solon in the bank, and have their first outright divisional championship in their sights. But there's a long way to go, and many tests against capable opponents await. Two-time defending champion CPU remains the chief threat. Vinton Shelsburg and Benton Community maintain their own title hopes, and Williamsburg at 3-5 is dangerous. Moving to the boys article, this is from Jeff Johnson, titled Boys Leagues Trying to Balance the Scales. It's also an overview article. It says the unofficial second half of the boys basketball season begins today, with some games in the area and around the state. Things really get kicked up a notch next week. The range of games played has been pretty extreme. Springville has gotten in 9, winning them all. Iowa City Liberty, Iowa City West, Cedar Rapids Prairie, Highland, Lone Tree, and South Tama have played just twice each. And he says, let's take a look at some of the area conferences of what we've seen so far. In the MVC Mississippi Division, Cedar Falls, 5-0 overall, is ranked second in Class 4A and the class of this division. An interesting note, Western Dubuque and Cedar Rapids Washington already have equaled their respective win totals of a season ago. WD, which has dropped from Class 4A to 3A this season, is 5-1. Its only loss, a two-pointer to Waterloo West. Washington is 4-1, its lone loss in its opener to Cedar Rapids Kennedy. Prairie is 0-2, but those losses have been by 6 and 1 point, respectively. In the MVC Valley Division, looks like there's more parity. Kennedy is off to a 3-0 conference start. Its losses, coming out of league, to Class 3A Marion and 4A No. 6 Ames. Liberty got off to a late start, not playing its first game until December 18th, but has a quality win over Prairie and a blowout of Cedar Rapids Jefferson. It's an uncharacteristic rebuilding season, it appears, for Iowa City West, which is 0-2, but 6'9" junior transfer Peter Moe has been awesome, averaging 32 points and 11.5 rebounds in the Trojans' opener. He's the son of former University of Iowa guard Jeff Moe. In the Wamak East Division, Dyersville-Beckman graduated All-State forward Michael Keegan, yet the Blazers are off to a 7-0 overall start and ranked 4th in Class 2A. Senior guard Mason White is averaging 21.4 points per game. Of the two divisions in the conference, this one appears to be the stronger. Solon, ranked 10th in 3A, also is unbeaten in league play and is 6-1 overall, one win shy of its total from last season. Mount Vernon at 3-2 has a D1 college player in senior guard Keaton Kutcher, South Dakota commit. Marion is last in the division right now and is a quality team with a win over 4A Kennedy. WAMAC West Division says Clear Creek Amana is coming off a season in which it finished third in 3A at the state tournament and has used that momentum to build a big division lead. The Clippers are 5-2 overall, 5-1 in the league. The next best league record belongs to Williamsburg at 2-4. River Valley North Division, Monticello is doing Monticello things, winning all six of its games thus far and by an average of 57 points per game. Yes, 57. The Panthers returned every starter from a 2A state tourney team, but have moved up to 3A and are ranked 7th. In the River Valley South Division, West Branch is setting the pace at 7-0 overall. And in league play, Mid Prairie is 3-1, 3-0 in the conference, its only loss coming to Williamsburg by 4. Iowa City Regina at 4-3 has won 3 in a row, a sign, perhaps, that the Regals are getting their collective basketball legs after a long and successful football season. In today's Gazette, they have the TV guide, and there's a brief article here about Pat Sajak and Vanna White and the Celebrity Wheel of Fortune. This is written by Jay Bobbin. It says, if you're playing Wheel of Fortune, you have to know which letters you want to choose. However, for a new celebrity version, three letters, namely ABC, did the choosing. The network adds Pat Sajak and Vanna White to its roster of primetime game show personalities as Celebrity Wheel of Fortune launches a new Thursday slate of contests starting January 7th. In the others, The View's Sarah Haynes hosts The Chase, and Craig Ferguson presides over The Hustler. Even with stars taking the spins, Wheel of Fortune remains the familiar game that's long been a syndication powerhouse, with the celebrity players donating their winnings to charities. The game itself always is the ultimate star of Wheel of Fortune, though, says Pat Sajak. He says, that's been part of my success, recognizing that it's not the Pat Sajak show. I may be the most charming and delightful host in the world, and I probably am. But if there's no game, there's nothing there. You can't get in the way of it. Viewers want to see the puzzle and solve it, says Sajak. Unlike most shows like Jeopardy, the object is not to try to solve the puzzle first. It's to try to make some money by picking as many individual letters as possible, so it's leisurely in that sense, the players not trying to solve it instantly. That should remain the case as celebrities vie to win money for the organizations they designate. With the late Alex Trebek having hosted a playoff between Jeopardy champions in a special ABC series last winter, Sajak believes that greased the wheel a little bit for the Celebrity Wheel of Fortune order. Sajak said, it's a tricky business. The one thing you don't want to start doing is overexpose the show. In some markets, you'll have a half hour of the syndicated Wheel of Fortune, followed by an hour of the ABC Wheel of Fortune, and I don't think you can do that too often without watering it down. But for a limited run like this, I think it's fine. Sajak appreciates the career longevity he's had thanks largely to Wheel of Fortune, which he has hosted since 1981. His popularity was reaffirmed by the fan outpouring during his absence after emergency intestinal surgery in late 2019. White moved over and filled in as host, and Sajak's country singer daughter Maggie was a guest letter turner. Sajak reflects, what I take the greatest pride in personally is that it's very tough to be welcomed into a house for nearly 40 years. The fact that Vanna and I still are is the best thing I can say about it from a talent or skill point of view. I wasn't sure we'd have time, but we are going to, so I'm going to go back to the Insight page where there are two letters from local public officials. One is from a guest column from Dave Lobzak. And it's titled, Record of Serving Iowans in Congress. As you may know, Dave Lobzak is retiring, and he has said this. As a child growing up in Sioux City, I never would have believed anyone if they told me I would have the opportunity to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives as the voice of Iowans. But these past 14 years have been an honor of a lifetime. During my travels across the district and state, I've had the opportunity to hear from thousands of you about your lives, your struggles, your triumphs, and most importantly, about what I could do to help. The Iowans I have met along the way are truly what I will miss most about serving in Congress. Throughout my time in Congress, our state has faced its share of natural disasters that required a significant attention and serious response from the federal government. One of the biggest challenges was the Great Flood of 2008 and its aftermath. Over half the damage from this flood occurred in the 2nd Congressional District. From Cedar Rapids to Iowa City and smaller towns along rivers and streams, there was unimaginable damage and destruction left in its path. Even though this flood happened years ago, its effects are still being felt today. I'm pleased to have worked with Iowa's congressional delegation to get the funding necessary to help folks get back on their feet and rebuild homes and businesses. Additionally, we worked to prevent this scale of a disaster from ever happening again. For instance, Iowa City saw Dubuque Street, a main thoroughfare into the city, razed and reconfigured to prevent a repeat of the 2008 disaster. And in Cedar Rapids, crews are building the long-awaited flood wall to protect the downtown area. There have also been additional mitigation efforts built across the state to protect homes, businesses, and property from flooding in the future. I was proud to lead the fight that, with the help of federal assistance, led to the completion of these vital projects. As a parent of two military children, I strongly believe that we must treat those who served with the same dedication that they gave to our nation. No veteran who needs care should be turned away. That is why I worked to get veterans the resources they need to get help with both physical and mental care. I proudly authorized the Brandon Ketchum Never Again Act to ensure veterans who are suffering from invisible wounds like PTSD are never denied care from a VA healthcare system when they are reaching out for help. It continues to be a shame that each day 20 veterans take their own lives. We cannot let this continue. Even one veteran who takes her own life is one too many. And there are many other issues I've worked on over the years, including expanding broadband to more remote areas of our state, helping to ensure that all Iowans have access to affordable, quality health care, including mental health care, and last but not least, providing educational opportunities to all Iowans so they can achieve the American dream for themselves and their loved ones. As my time in office comes to an end, I never thought it would be wrapping up in the middle of a worldwide pandemic. I'm hopeful that there is light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccine beginning to be administered. But in the meantime, I urge all of you to continue to follow the CDC safety guidelines to protect yourself, loved ones, and the larger community. While I may not have been able to say thank you in person to every one of you, please know that everyone who called, emailed, or stopped me at a convenience or grocery store to share their thoughts made an impact on me and my time in Congress. I could not have done my job directly without hearing directly from Iowans. Again, thank you for your support over the years. It's been an honor to serve the people of Iowa. Dave Lobsack was elected in 2006 to the U.S. House of Representatives. And finally, we have an article, a guest column from Janice Weiner, who was elected to the Iowa City Council in 2019. And she says, under the title, Justice, Virus, and Climate Need Focus. I approach the task of focusing on what I hope we as a council can accomplish in 2021 with great humility, not because I don't have goals, but because 2020 demonstrated that no matter how thorough our plans, they can be quickly overtaken by events. 1 year ago, I assumed we'd focus on zoning, climate change-related issues, the transit study, and affordable housing. None of us could have imagined that a pandemic, combined with long-overdue social justice movements, would come to the forefront. As the self-appointed COVID bulldog on the Iowa City Council, I will continue that work as we strive to keep people as safe as possible, support our healthcare and essential workers, help as many as we can, and get people vaccinated. We must deal effectively with COVID to allow other crucial aspects of our daily lives to recover. Black Lives Matter is indispensable work that will continue for the duration of my term on council and beyond. Whatever we do, from our 17-point resolution to starting the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to working on reforms to our police department, coordinating with the new GuideLink Center, providing education, healing, seeking equity, access, and transparency, it is ongoing, necessary work. I hope the coming year will be one of gradual recovery, an opportunity to knit community together at all levels. I aim to work across government entities and with our nonprofit community in a meaningful way, because coordination allows us to learn from one another and to avoid duplication of efforts. I would also like to spearhead changes to our zoning laws to make it easier to create the missing middle and simplify requirements where possible. I want to continue to focus on creating a new affordable housing plan, bringing all stakeholders to the table, including those who know the cost to build nonprofits that support affordable housing and those who live in affordable units. We must also view everything we do through the climate change lens. Our house is on fire, and we must do all in our power to extinguish it. We must also focus on improving communication. Finally, it will always be about public service, serving our people and our community, about appreciating our people, both staff and volunteers, who both showed enormous flexibility and grit in 2020, as did our citizens, and continuing to endeavor to make our city a better place to live. Well, that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, January 2nd. I've been your reader, Mary Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.